This is White Collared, the podcast, season 3, episode 8, As You Were. I would like to thank you for joining me for this, another episode of White Collared, the podcast, which is a retrospective commentary on the USA Network television series White Collar. My name is Eric Altenglenn Hilliard. As You Were first aired on July 26th, 2011. It was written by Matt Negrete and directed by David Straitman. When Clinton Jones comes home to find an intruder in his home, he and the team are drawn into a case involving a powerful private security firm with international reach, an ex-army buddy of Clinton's, and the buddy's wife, a woman with whom Clinton has a history. The episode begins and we see Sarah. She's at the table in Neil's apartment. If you recall in the last episode, she had flipped open the laptop that had the treasure cam installed on it and had typed in the password. That was the password that she had seen Neil type in a reflection. And so in this episode, she sits at the table on the laptop in front of her. The treasure cam is on screen. She's looking at the images presented by the treasure cam on the laptop screen. And as she scrolls the camera around, seeing the various valuables in the warehouse, it is obvious that she is devastated by what she sees. After a moment, there's a knock on the door. It's Neil. The door is locked, and he says something to her, and she closes the laptop and puts a stack of books on it. Now, the books had been there on the laptop earlier, but she doesn't stack them the same way that Neil had stacked them when he left. So there's a good chance that if he has any recollection of how he placed the books, he's going to notice that they aren't the same and that something has been changed, and he's going to suspect. Anyway, Sarah gets up. She opens the door. Neil's standing there with a bottle of wine, and he comes in, but he sees Sarah's suitcases.
What's going on? Are you leaving?
The renovations on my apartment are far enough along that I can move back in.
Doesn't mean you have to head out right this second.
Neil, I'm leaving. Done.
A few hours ago, we were fine. Now you're walking out. What happened?
We're two very different people.
Oh, come on, Sarah. You've always known who I am.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. I guess you figured out everything I have to offer. We could be good together.
Now you live in the clouds. And I live on West 69th.
I never promised you anything else. Well, you found your way out.
Kevin, please take care of yourself.
Now, as Neil says that Sarah doesn't have to leave right away, not this very second, he moves toward her, and she backs away. She is trying to keep distance between herself and him. She's separating herself from him. And Neil says, you've always known who I am. And Sarah says, you're right. I think Neil views who he is as a permanent state, unchanging state. That's what he is. That's what he'll always be. It's a basic fact of his life. That's who he is. I think Sarah viewed who he is as a current but transitory fact, a changeable state, something that isn't necessarily what he's going to be all his life. She recognized that, yes, he had lived his life up to this point on the other side of that line that she wouldn't cross. But I think she thought that he was moving toward the side of the line that she was on. But now her acknowledgement of always having known who he is really an acknowledgement that she was reading the situation incorrectly, that he wasn't moving toward her side of the line, but was maybe at minimum expecting the two of them to coexist on their separate sides of the line. Or perhaps he hoped that he could move the line without her realizing it so that she would actually end up on his side of the line, but kind of justify it by saying, well, no, the line was never over there. It's always been over here. I don't think that Sarah was foolishly optimistic about the possibility of Neil changing, but I think it was always something of a long shot. The odds were always against it, unless his life on the outside of the law brought him so completely to the bottom that he wanted to cross that line the other direction. back over onto Sarah's side. And as they're having this conversation, Neil looks over at the laptop on the table. I think he realizes that things are not as he left them. He puts two and two together, and I think that's what he means when he says, "I guess you figured out everything I have to offer." I think he knows that Sarah somehow saw the treasure in the treasure cam. Now, previously in the Taking Account episode, I had talked about how there's often a moment and an instant within that moment when one can either push through the barrier and reveal the things that they've been wanting to reveal, or they pull back. And I think this is another one of those moments for Neil. It's another moment that he could have pushed through, not only to reveal what he's been wanting to reveal to Sarah, because he did want to reveal that to Sarah. He was very close to revealing that to Sarah before. But it would also be an opportunity for him to push through to cross over to the other side of the line, onto Sarah's side. This is an opportunity for him to explain to her what happened, how it happened that they have the treasure, and for him to genuinely offer to give it up all for her and to walk away from it and let Mozzie keep it for himself if he truly wanted to keep building the relationship with her. And I think he's clever enough that he could have done it without having to make it a choice between Sarah and Mozzie, without having to throw Mozzie under the bus. Yes, it would change the nature of the relationship between him and Mozzie, but it wouldn't have to destroy it, and it wouldn't have to put Mozzie in an untenable position. I think Neil could have done that. But instead, he tries to draw her across the line that he knows that she won't cross to his side of the line by saying, "We could be good together." Well, he knows she's not going to cross that line. And that's almost him killing the relationship and setting it up so that he can blame her for it. It sounds a little... Yeah, that doesn't sound nice, but that does seem to be kind of what he's aiming for here. On my terms, or you walk away and we're going to blame you for it. Now, Sarah tearfully agrees that, yes, she knows that they could be good together, but their visions of good together are different and incompatible. And just before Sarah leaves, Neil commented that she had found her way out. It's something of an accusation. Like I said, he's trying to set it up so that she's the one who breaks off the relationship. And he's saying it as if he knows, or he's implying that she's been looking for an excuse to get out of the relationship. And now she's got it. Like I said, he's trying to set it up for her to be at fault for the relationship failing. I think it's also a little bit of self-pity. It's him feeling sorry for himself that another relationship has ended. I do have to say, though, that Sarah is a little bit to blame for this relationship failing. Now, Neil's setting it up for her to take all the blame. She's not responsible for the whole thing, but she is partially responsible because, after all, she is the one who's leaving, not him. And it's not like she didn't know who he was or what he was from the very beginning. That's all true. But like I said, he also knew who and what she was, and yet he still got into the relationship with her. So if there's blame to be shared, and I think there's plenty of blame to go around, it's at least as much his fault as hers, maybe more so. Anyway, after she leaves, telling him to take care of himself and giving him a kiss, Neil walks over to the table, shoves the books off the top of the laptop, and stares down at it. We have a time jump, and we see Peter and Neil walking through the streets. Neil has told Peter that Sarah has walked out of his life. No, it wasn't mutual. She said, "We are different people." Peter interjects, "Well, of course you're different. That's what makes life interesting. What next? You just let her go?" Neil says, "It's over. It's for the best." After all, he scoffs, "It's not like they were star-crossed lovers." But Peter isn't quite buying it, but he doesn't make an issue of it. They walk up to a van, slide the door open, and enter, joining Clinton and Diana inside. Jones and Diana update Peter on the state of their current surveillance. Comments are exchanged about various things, including Clinton's tuna fish sandwich smelling up the van. And I would say tuna fish is definitely not a good sandwich choice in this sort of situation. And Jones is clearly eager to get out of the van. Perhaps it was the tuna fish sandwich, or perhaps it was something in the conversation that took place before Peter's arrival, but Diana seems willing to let Clinton go, and she says that he's got that look, like he's dying to get out of the van. Jones takes off, and we follow him as he heads home, first walking and then in a cab. When Jones arrives home, he gets out of the cab, approaches the security gate, which is at the top of the stairs leading to his basement apartment, but it's open. And from his reaction, he's certain that he didn't leave it unlocked when he left. He looks around, doesn't seem to see anybody or anything suspicious. Concerned that whomever broke into his apartment could still be there, he draws his weapon, then carefully proceeds down into the apartment. As he steps through the door, he sees a man dressed in black, ski mask pulled down over his face, and what appears to be a postcard or envelope in his hand. Jones apparently sees that the man has a weapon in a side holster, or perhaps he assumes that he does, because from their relative positions, I can't see how Jones would have spotted it. Anyway, he orders the man to drop his weapon, kick it away, and then orders the man to pull off his mask. The man responds that, hey, he doesn't want any trouble, but it's a distraction. There's a room fan nearby with a power cord and a foot switch near the intruder on the floor. And while Clinton has his attention focused on the response, the intruder shifts his foot to the button, presses it down, turning on the fan. And I got a question, who has a room fan with a foot switch on it? And running across the middle of the floor without something to keep it from being tripped on? You know, one of those little plastic runners that goes over a power cord? Or at least duct taping it down? Jones is a little bit careless, it would seem. Anyway, when the fan powers on and the blades start spinning, Jones's attention is broken long enough for the suspect to make a move on Jones. And then the two struggle for Jones's pistol. And in the course of that struggle, several shots are fired in random directions, one of them going through the flat screen TV hanging from a wall. Soon the gun goes flying out of the reach of both men, leaving the two of them to go at each other with their fists, feet, frying pans, and other found objects. The intruder kicks Jones to the floor, giving himself enough of an advantage that he is able to head to the door, but not before Clinton is able to recover his pistol and get off a few more shots. This time the shots are aimed, and they are aimed at the suspect. Jones does manage to get at least one hit on the intruder, but by the time he gets to his feet, out the door, and up the stairs to follow the masked man, there is no one to be seen. We have a time jump, and we see a team of agents swarming over Jones's apartment. Neil is there as well. Jones identifies the intruder as a professional trained in Kali. Now, Kali is an ancient martial arts form from the Philippines. It emphasizes weapons-based fighting with sticks, knives, bladed weapons, and various improvised weapons, as well as open hand techniques. Open hand as in without weapons. Because almost all of its history is anecdotal and oral, the history of the technique is apparently subject to some debate, but one of the earliest documented references to Kali is that it was practiced by Filipino armies against the Spaniards in the 1500s. It has been incorporated by special forces across the planet into their close quarters combat training. Anyway, Jones confirms that yes, he did hit the guy in the shoulder with one of his shots, but Peter says that the guy managed to get away, calling him a ghost. And of course the question is asked, what was the guy after? Jones shows Peter and Neil a postcard. It's from Jimmy Wilson, an old buddy of Clinton's from his Annapolis days. It does seem odd to Peter that someone would break into Jones's apartment just to steal a postcard. Neil observes that, in his experience, cryptic postcards from old friends mean trouble. And that seems to be a reference to Matthew Keller's postcard in Season 1, Episode 12, Bottlenecked. And you'll recall where that ended up. Jones says that Jimmy had been working for Barrett Dunn Security, which is essentially a mercenary organization, and the postcard was postmarked from Pretoria, South Africa. Neil examines the postcard, holding it up to the light to shine through it from the back, and it reveals that there is something under the stamp. It's a microdot. Peter comments, yeah, that's pretty old school. And Neil agrees, but points out that in order to do it, all you need is a film camera and a pair of scissors. We have another time jump, and we see Peter, Jones, and Neil on a street corner, presumably on their way to the FBI building. Peter reports that the FBI has finished their work on the microdot and are sending it over to the team. Jones reports that Barrett Dunn confirms Jimmy as an employee, but beyond that, they're stonewalling. We do learn that Barrett Dunn apparently makes Blackwater, which is a controversial organization in its own right, with a history of questionable ethics, morals, and national loyalties. Barrett Dunn manages to make them look soft, cuddly, and cute in comparison, and that Barrett Dunn has been linked with rogue kill teams and death squads. Jones says he doesn't get it, saying that Jimmy is one of the good guys. They met at the academy, they served their tour together, and they were like brothers, although they hadn't talked in 5 years. Jimmy had stayed in the military, Jones went to Harvard Law. Peter says that, well, maybe Jimmy's wife, Isabel, can shed some light on whatever trouble Jimmy's in. She had come in earlier in the morning and is with Diana giving a statement. Now, Jones is momentarily taken aback, but when pressed by Peter if her presence was a problem, Jones assures him, no, no problem. And we see Peter, Neil, and Jones arrive at the FBI. Diana has finished talking with Isabel and taken her statement, and the two women meet up with the three men in the bullpen. But the moment is clearly uncomfortable for both Clinton and Isabel, who first nervously shake, then after hesitation, they hug. Clinton asks if she has any news from Jimmy. Isabel says no, but she's told Diana everything that she does know, and if it turns out that Jimmy's fine, he's in big trouble with her. When Peter comments that it seems the two of them have met, referring to Isabel and Clinton, Isabel haltingly says that, well, CJ and I were a bit almost married once. A few side comments are exchanged between Peter, Diana, and Neil, and then Jones introduces Isabel to Peter and Neil. Jones offers to walk Isabel out, and we learn that Clinton has always been an overachiever, that Isabel is a linguistics professor at Princeton, and Jones knows this because he's looked her up. Since it appears that he hasn't had time to do that since the break-in at his apartment, he must have been doing it at some time in the past. You know, one of those, I wonder what my old girlfriend is up to and what she's looking like now sort of things. Anyway, Clinton finally assures Isabel that if Jimmy really is in trouble, he, Peter, and the team will sort it out. Next, we jump to the conference room where the team is getting updated on the case. Barrett Dunn owns and operates a palladium mine in Pretoria, South Africa, where the postcard was from. Palladium is used in cell phones, computers, and auto parts, and is over 20 times more valuable than silver. Jimmy had been sent there to beef up security by a man known as Stryker. Isabel met him once, but didn't get his real name. The FBI has requested Barrett Dunn's employee files and photos to try and identify the man known as Stryker, but the company's not cooperating. Stryker had bragged to Isabel about securing contracts in India and China, and Isabel said that in her last conversation with Jimmy, he believed that the company was keeping a close eye on him, monitoring his personal communications, including his outgoing snail mail, which would explain the microdot, as it might have been the only way he could get information out without it being discovered. From the microdot, the FBI techs have extracted a schematic of the aforementioned palladium mine, but when it is compared with the schematic of the same mine filed with the Department of Mineral Resources, there's a discrepancy. It appears that there's an entire annex that isn't on the official map. The conclusion is that if that off-the-record section of the mine is what Jimmy was pointing them to, then someone at Barrett Dunn, possibly Stryker, wants to stop Jimmy from sharing that information with anyone. The FBI's best chance at this point of finding Jimmy is to figure out what Stryker's up to, and Peter directs the team to find out as much as they can about the mine and Barrett Dunn. The briefing breaks up, and everyone leaves the room except Diana and Peter. They begin having a closed-door conference about these stolen sub-treasures. It seems that their patience may have paid off. DC Art Crimes has found a storage vault in Baltimore with a new Cezanne. They don't know yet if it's one of the paintings listed on the partial manifest that they have, but they have photos of the painting in question coming their way. But as they're talking, Neil is outside the room, surreptitiously recording a video of Peter as he's talking. Next, we jump to Neil and Mozzie walking through the streets. Mozzie is expressing his condolences to Neil about Sarah calling off the relationship, but, you know, it was inevitable since the plan is to sell the treasures and then leave town, you know, providing we find a way to start selling the art without drawing unwanted attention to themselves. This last bit prompts Neil to bring up the fact that he knows Peter and Diana are up to something, mentioning that they've had two closed-door meetings in as many days. He pulls out his cell phone and plays the video for Mozzie that he took of Peter in that conference room. Now, there's no audio, but Mozzie apparently can read lips after a fashion, and he reads Peter saying, "New Cezanne or Rue McClanahan?" Probably New Cezanne. And, of course, they just happen to have a couple of Cezannes in their warehouse, Bridge Over a Pond and the Mount of St. Victoria. And both of these are titles of actual paintings by Cezanne, although I don't find any specific reference of them having been part of Nazi plunder during World War II. although given the amount of art and treasures that the Nazis stole from various countries and citizens across Europe, it wouldn't be a surprise if they had been. Mozzie is surprised that Peter's still looking into the art from the U-boat, but Neil says that Peter's just not one to give it up, which Mozzie should have known. Even though he hasn't had as much direct contact with Peter as Neil has, he should know enough from the contact that he has had and what he should have learned through Neil that Peter would just never give it up. Now, he might put something on the back burner for a while, but he would never give it up. And, of course, Mozzie is understandably concerned about what Peter's up to, and Neil says, well, he'll try to find out. We have another time jump, and we are back at the FBI where Diana is updating Peter and Neil. The previous week, the manager of the palladium mine had arranged to talk to a local reporter about something illegal happening at the mine, but she was killed just before she had a chance to talk to the reporter. Jones says it seems like an attempt at a cover-up. Peter says that if Jimmy's involved in murder, but he doesn't finish. He doesn't need to. What he means is clear. But Clinton assures Peter that, no, Jimmy isn't involved. After all, he sent the postcard to expose the truth, not to cover it up. But the only way to prove Jimmy's innocence is to find Stryker, which Barrett Dunn may inadvertently have helped them to do since the company is hosting a reception the next day. In addition to the invited guests, active and retired military personnel are also invited. So the team figures there's a good chance Stryker will be there. And since Jones is former military, he can go, taking Isabel with him to make an ID. Jones is hesitant. Peter says, well, if that's a problem, you know, given your history with her. Jones decides it's time to clear the air. He and Isabel met in his last year at Annapolis, and they were together the entire time that he was going through law school. But in the end, Jones chose the FBI, and Isabel chose Jimmy. End of story. But despite his attempt to clear the air and to show that it's all behind him, it's clear that it isn't completely behind him when he says about taking Isabel to the open house the next day. Yeah, should be fun. Next, we are at that reception, and we can see that it is being held at or near the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum at Pier 86 on the Hudson River. Jones, in his dress whites, arrives at the reception. Peter is not far away, keeping in touch with Jones electronically. Jones meets up with Isabel. They exchange a few pleasantries. Then she sees Stryker enter and directs Jones's attention to him. Jones steps over to one of the reception staff and asks the name of the commander that Isabel had pointed out. It's Henry Van Horn, COO of Barrett Dunn. Peter, monitoring the conversation, hears and immediately gets Diana checking on Van Horn. Jones notes in his electronic bug that the commander seems to have some bruises on his neck, as if he had been in a fight recently. He, of course, doesn't know for sure that it's the guy who attacked him earlier, but yeah, he's going to find out. Jones approaches, introduces himself with a handshake and a friendly pat on the arm, which causes Van Horn to wince. And Jones tells Van Horn that he's looking for Jimmy Wilson, and would the commander have any idea where he is? Van Horn tells Jones to ask Jimmy's wife. Isabel turns to the commander and says, yeah, he already did. Now, Van Horn begins attacking. First, he attacks Jimmy's character, saying that he abandoned his post. Then Isabel's character, suggesting that perhaps Isabel is close to abandoning her husband. Ignoring the comment, Isabel replies that Jimmy wouldn't have disappeared without a reason. Van Horn says that Jimmy has a nasty habit of getting in over his head. Fortunately for Van Horn, his phone rings, giving him a chance to get away. As Jones is speaking to Peter, telling him that Van Horn owes him a flat-screen TV, we see Van Horn speaking to someone, telling them to find Jimmy because he can blow the whole thing. Jones tells Peter that Van Horn is leaving the party, but at the same time, Peter spots Jimmy. Peter calls out to him, assures him that the FBI can protect him, but Jimmy says no, no one can help him. Jimmy spots Van Horn coming down a walkway, and Peter calls out for Jimmy not to run, but he ignores Peter. He turns and runs, and as he's doing so, he drops a single round of ammunition to the ground. Peter, realizing it was an intentional act, not an accident, walks over to the dropped round, pulls out a handkerchief from his pocket, and then picks up the round. We have a short time jump, and we see Clinton and Isabel are walking down a sidewalk talking. She doesn't understand why Jimmy ran. If he had turned himself in, the FBI would have protected him, and he would have been safe. Jones explains that Jimmy doesn't think he would be safe. After all, Barrett Dunn is powerful, and has powerful friends in positions of influence, or they have power over people in positions of influence. Jimmy came back to try and expose whatever they're up to. Isabel decides that she needs to get a few things off her chest about Jimmy. Whatever's going on, she says, Jimmy is, or at least was, involved. After getting to the mine, he had begun sending home cash. A lot of cash. Nearly $100,000 in cash. And he had tried to pass it off as a bonus. Jones is, let's say, more than slightly annoyed that she hadn't mentioned it sooner. After all, this does change things about the case. The FBI's tactics in trying to find him and bring him in have been based somewhat on the presumption that he may be an innocent pawn and would welcome the FBI finding him and protecting him. Well, now this logic and this presumption may be flawed, since Jimmy is not only going to be concerned about Barrett Dunn and what they might do to him, but he's also going to be concerned about what happens if the FBI catches him. Isabel apologizes after a fashion, saying that he's her husband and she felt she had to try to protect him. When Jones asks how Jimmy even got mixed up with an outfit like Barrett Dunn, she says, well, it's partly because Jimmy always felt that he needed to be a better provider, and so was always pushing to do more, make more, and frankly, be more like Jones, who was, as she puts it, the gold standard. And this surprises Jones, saying he's nothing special. He works in a van. He lives under the stairs. But Isabel assures him that he is something special. He's a good man. Back at the FBI, Diana comes into Peter's office for another closed-door meeting. It's a good news, bad news thing. This is on that the DC Art Crimes located is a genuine article, and that's the good news. The bad news is that it's not one of the paintings on the manifest. Diana hesitates a moment and then asks, what if they spent all this time and energy looking for something that isn't there? Looking out at Neil working at a desk in the bullpen, Peter says, honestly, he'd be relieved. As Peter and Diana continue their closed-door meeting, Neil is eyeing a manila envelope sitting on a nearby desk. He gets up, works his way toward the desk, and manages to find a way to knock the envelope to the floor so he can pick it up. And as he does, he looks at the addresses and markings on the front. To Diana Kerrigan, from DC Art Crimes, photos do not bend. Next, it's night. Neil and Mozzie are at the apartment. Neil tells Mozzie that Peter has requested photos from DC Art Crimes, and that he thinks Peter still has a copy of the U-Boat Manifest. Mozzie sees this as an opportunity to redeem their prior failure to secure the manifest back in the episode Deadline. The question is, where would Peter keep it? Neil says it would be risky to keep it at the FBI, but it is possible. Neil says that he can go back this evening, late, and take a look around. Later, Neil does show up at the FBI to look for that manifest, but is surprised to find Peter still there. At his desk, in the semi-darkness, contemplating the single round of ammunition dropped for him by Jimmy Wilson. Neil walks to Peter's office, and Peter tosses him the round, asking him what he sees. At first, all Neil sees is a brass casing, as he would expect to see. But at Peter's direction, he takes a closer look. He realizes that he can pull the bullet from the casing, which he shouldn't be able to do by hand, and sees that instead of being filled with gunpowder, it's filled with palladium, which doesn't seem to make sense. So they begin talking through the problem. Van Horn personally sends Jimmy to the mine. Jimmy gets involved in something illegal there. The manager of the mine is killed when she says she's going to talk. But Jimmy didn't think it would escalate to murder, so now he wants out. Peter suggests that, well, maybe perhaps Jimmy ran because he's involved in the murder. Neil asks, somewhat accusingly, if Peter always presumes guilt. Peter observes that guilty people do guilty things. But for the sake of discussion, they decide to assume that Jimmy isn't involved in the murder, but Van Horn is. If Van Horn realized that Jimmy was planning to bail, he might sit on him, start monitoring all his communications. Jimmy sends Jones the microdot, slips back into the country, and delivers Peter a bullet that contains palladium. Barrett Dunn had contracts in India and China, both countries with a high demand for palladium. It's not illegal to import palladium into those countries, but there are tariffs. And if they can smuggle palladium into those countries without having to pay the tariffs, they can save tens of millions of dollars every year. Peter decides it's time that he and Van Horn had a chat. The next day at the FBI, Clinton goes into Peter's office and tells him that Van Horn is on his way up. But Clinton doesn't seem too thrilled about it. Of course, Peter already realizes what's going to happen. So when Van Horn arrives, Peter cuts him off as soon as he starts to talk.
Afternoon, agents.
Let's see it. In the interest of national security, all Barrett Dunn interviews to be conducted by and scheduled through the U.S. Attorney's Office.
My friends over there say they're busy, although they may be able to fit you in sometime next spring.
You got the DOJ in your pocket. You must think you're pretty special, huh?
Agent Jones, I almost didn't recognize you without your best friend's wife on your arm.
This doesn't end here, Van Horn. You got friends in high places? So do I.
We're gonna find Jimmy, and then we're gonna take you down.
And I suggest using less cologne. You wouldn't want Jimmy smelling you on his wife when he gets back.
Hey, easy. Let him go. Come on, come on. Let him go. Let him go.
You got stones. I respect that. Tell you what. You get tired of cheap suits and government wages, you give me a call.
You're above this.
Frankly, it's understandable that Jones would want to get physical with Van Horn. Of course, Van Horn is deliberately trying to provoke a reaction for a couple of reasons. First, it serves as a distraction. Make it all personal and get Jones focused on responding in a personal manner, taking his concentration off the investigation. Second, Van Horn realizes that far too many people blame the person responding to a provocation as somehow being the instigator and treat the provocateur as the victim, failing to recognize that the provocateur is the instigator. And that the person responding to the provocation was simply behaving as any normal person would be expected to do in such a case. I mean, it's a bit like poking a bear with a stick, trying to provoke a reaction, and then blaming the bear when it gets tired of it and reacts. You don't blame the bear, you blame the person who was poking at it with the stick. And you tell the idiot with the stick that he had it coming. And like so many bullies and abusers, Van Horn uses verbal degradation as a means of controlling people who are unable, for whatever reason, to fight back. And Jones really isn't in a position to fight back because too many people would use that as an excuse to excuse Van Horn's behavior and his crimes and to scuttle the investigation. Van Horn's also doing kind of the same thing on a more sophisticated level when he uses the power, position, and influence of his company to manipulate the system into protecting him from being investigated for his crimes. All in the name of national security, a horribly abused phrase and authority that has given far too many people too much power and free rein to commit and cover up as many vicious, heinous crimes as they wish, knowing that they can simply say those two magic words and use the power of government to protect themselves from the prosecution and punishment that they deserve and have earned, and to further turn around and persecute and destroy those who've already been victims of those crimes because they're going to ask questions and that makes them a national security threat by asking questions about a national security issue. And so they get harassed, arrested, charged with crimes against national security. Can't win for losing on those. Anyway, next we have a time jump. Peter and Neil are at the office and Peter is telling Neil that they've gotten a warrant to monitor Van Horn's cell phone. When Neil asks how he managed that, Peter says, yeah, he's got a friend at the U.S. Attorney's Office, and he bought an ungodly amount of her daughter's band candy. That's too bad the daughter's band wasn't selling Texas Manor fruitcakes. People get tired of buying candy, and I know a lot of people think that they hate fruitcake, but it's only because so many of them haven't tasted a good fruitcake, and believe me, Texas Manor fruitcakes are good fruitcakes. And if it had been me, I wouldn't have been any more happy about buying a bunch of candy than Peter was, but I wouldn't have complained at all about buying a few Texas Manor fruitcakes. I love those things. Anyway, Peter leaves the office and heads out into the hallway toward the elevators, and Neil slips a piece of gum in his mouth and begins chewing. He moves into Peter's office and begins poking around, looking on and in his desk, and then finally checking the pockets of Peter's jacket that's hanging over the back of the chair. And that's where he finds a key. Neil grabs a pad of paper, smashes the gum onto the top sheet, and then presses first one side of the key and then the other side into the gum, after which he carefully folds the paper over the gum with the impression, returns the key, resets the items on the desk, and leaves. Next, we see Neil and Mozzie are on the street, walking and talking, and Mozzie presents a key to Neil, the key he made from the impressions that Neil had made in the gum.
It opens a Ravener 1028 key lock combination wall safe, top of the line.
Those have only been on the market a couple months.
Yeah, it means the suit recently acquired something that needs upgraded protection. The art manifest.
The timing works out.
If it's hiding it in this house...
Find the safe and crack it.
We have to break into the Burks.
Okay, how about I lure the Burks out and you break in?
Oh, I do the dirty work?
I have to smile into their faces. That work is plenty dirty, my friend. Neil, no one said this was going to be easy.
Yeah, I know, Oz.
The timing couldn't be more perfect. Sarah no longer? What's keeping you here?
Well, it seems obvious that Mozzie doesn't want to be the one to have to break into the Burke home. And it's not because he isn't able to do it. He is. I think it's absolutely because he's developed an affection for Elizabeth that makes it very uncomfortable for him to even think about violating the sanctity of their home. It's not enough that he won't keep them occupied while Neil does it. He just doesn't want to be the one to do it. Also, I think that Mozzie's question to Neil about what's keeping him there shows that Mozzie's been kind of losing touch with Neil on a personal level. And it's probably as much Neil's fault as Mozzie's. They have different visions and goals now. Mozzie has mostly remained true to his nature of no emotional attachments, no loyalties, save himself and Neil, and keep the treasure. But Neil's relationship with Peter and his relationship with Sarah and the lessons from Byron and Ford have started Neil seeing things differently. But he hasn't been telling any of this to Mozzie. He's been keeping it to himself. So their friendship has been, it's been drifting apart, which Neil is fighting with himself over. But Mozzie seems to be nearly totally oblivious. He sees glimmers of Neil's fighting with himself, Neil's changed attitude from time to time, but not really enough to believe what he's seen. He thinks it's just kind of surface in the moment. Anyway, they plan the break-in for Friday, since that will be Peter's poker night, and Mozzie will keep Elizabeth occupied. We then see a brief scene of Neil returning to the apartment and looking down at the remainder of Sarah's things packed in a suitcase and a bag, waiting to be delivered back to her own apartment. Then we jump to Clinton's apartment, where there's a knock on the door. Jones answers it, and it's Neil. Neil tells Jones that they got the wiretap on Van Horn, but really, he's arrived there with something to drink and to share, and to share some conversation.
Screwed up a little bit. But you're a good man, Jones.
Yeah? Then why did I let Van Horn get to me?
Same reason that landed me consecutive 4-year prison sentences.
What? An almost sociopathic need to tell lies of omission and get something for nothing.
I was gonna say passion.
Passion.
That makes the world go round. Passion to get what we want, passion to keep what we have, passion to get back the things we lost.
I think the conversation and the company and the need to get away from the apartment and the reminders and remainders of Sarah are really the reasons why Neil is there at Clinton's apartment. And yet, despite the fact he's trying to get away from the reminders of Sarah, the entire conversation is really about Sarah. Sarah and Neil. And Neil's conflicting passions. Passion to get what we want, he says. Well, his passion for wealth and the easy life, and his passion for Sarah and a relationship like he sees with Peter and Elizabeth. That's what he wants. Passion to keep what we have, he says. His passion to keep both the treasure and Sarah, not giving up either one. And then his passions to get back the things we lost. His passion to keep Sarah and to keep the relationship that he had with Kate alive through Sarah. But of course, although Neil is talking about Sarah, Jones is talking about Isabel. He says he left Isabel because he would have made her miserable, saying that she would have had to quit her job and move to the city, and with the hours he keeps at the bureau, they would have never seen each other. So he made the choice to leave. Now, it strikes me that during his entire statement, he never indicates that he considered a compromise on his part, maybe trying to get an assignment to a position where Isabel wouldn't have to move, a position that was office-based, which would have given him something of a regular schedule and at regular hours rather than being in the field with all the unpredictableness of that. He doesn't say anything to indicate that he even talked to Isabel about any of this. Maybe he did. Maybe she had already said some things during their relationship which told him that these things would be true. But it comes across as if he just assumed all these things on her behalf without actually talking to her. But after his recounting of his choices from a historical perspective, Jones gets philosophical about it all.
We can't have it all, right?
No, why not?
Why not? Well, because choices are sacrifices. And inevitably, that means giving up something that you want for something that you want more. So now I have to ask, what does having it all mean to Neil Caffrey?
Never having to worry about money. Doing something that's meaningful, being surrounded by people I care about and respect, you know, it's pretty much a dream.
Screw you.
Screw me.
Screw you. You already live in the dream.
Oh, come
on. You are the damned dream with a tracking ankle. Am I wrong?
Well, screw you back, Jones, because you got the same things I do.
Yeah, well, maybe not the same living arrangements.
All right.
I guess I do have it pretty good, don't I?
Yeah. Guess we both do.
Choices are sacrifices. They're about giving up something that you want for something that you want more. I think this notion hits Neil. I think we can see that in his face, in his manner, in the way he responds to that statement. It's almost as if this notion never occurred to him before, despite the fact that his entire life, his relationship with Kate, his relationship with Sarah, even his freedom, all of these things are things that he sacrificed by his choices. Those things that he chose might have been things that he really wanted in the moment, but they were just momentary wants. But things like Kate and Sarah and his freedom, those were things that he wanted more in the long run. But he doesn't think long run. He doesn't think beyond the moment, beyond the next step. He doesn't consider the down-the-line implications of his decisions, the long-term consequences to his long-term wants from the in-the-moment decisions he makes, because in the moment, he actually wants something more than those other things. And in the moment, he's willing to sacrifice those other things. It's like a gambler or a drug addict who knows that what they're doing is going to cost them something that they hold dear, but they just can't resist it in the moment. They can't resist that bet. They can't resist those drugs. They can't resist that alcohol in the moment, even though they know outside of that moment that those are not the things that they want the most, that it's these other things that they want. But they still, in that moment, they want those things more. And when Neil starts answering Clinton's questions about what does having it all mean to Neil Caffrey, he starts out where he's always started out, never having to worry about money. That's kind of been the motivator for his entire life. But then he moves into doing something that's meaningful, being surrounded by people that I care about and respect. Being surrounded by people he cares about and respects might be possible in the criminal world to some degree, but not in the way I think he means it when he says it here. I think he really means surrounded by the people he cares about and respects in the honest world that he's currently kind of living in. Because you can respect a criminal's skills and you might even care about a fellow criminal, but I mean, what does that mean really? A criminal is by definition a person who is untrustworthy. They may befriend a fellow miscreant and they may trust them and care about them up to a point, but it's hard to imagine that criminals have anything other than themselves as a first priority. And that at some point they will throw somebody under the bus if it means saving themselves. They are, after all, by definition, a person who is untrustworthy. And it's hard to care and respect about somebody who may at any moment abandon you or worse, turn on you to save themselves. Now, as far as the doing something meaningful, as we discussed in Scott Free, you can't do something meaningful when you are doing something that's built on dishonesty. It's oxymoronic. You can't steal from one person and give it to someone else and claim to have done a good thing. It's still stolen goods. It's really just a form of money laundering. And that's a crime because laundered money is still stolen money. And I don't think Neil is saying these things because he's playing a part or trying to pull a con of sorts on Jones or being insincere and flippant. He's trying to come off that way as being lighthearted, but I think he really means it. I think he realizes that he really means it. And I think it scares him a bit, which is why he tries to lighten it up when he tries to sound casual by throwing out his comment about how, you know, that's pretty much the dream, as if to say, yeah, I'm just talking. I think Jones realizes that in his case, okay, maybe the pity party is just that. It's a pity party because, you know, he really does have things pretty good. Anyway, the two of them go silent for a moment, and then there's a knock on the door. They joke about who the unexpected visitor might be and what sort of damage they might do to Clinton's apartment now that he's finally gotten it all cleaned up. But then Clinton goes and answers the door. It's Isabel. He shows her in, and Neil decides to make a tactful exit. She apologizes at having dragged him into this situation, but Clinton doesn't seem to feel too bad about it, saying it gave him a chance to see her again. They kiss briefly, but then Jones's phone rings. It's Peter, with bad news. Barrett Dunn has kidnapped Jimmy. In the FBI conference room, the team is listening to a recorded phone conversation with Jimmy and Van Horn. Jimmy's telling Van Horn that he's planted evidence of the murders, the smuggling, and more throughout the city, and that he's arranged for it all to go public if they kill Jimmy. But Van Horn isn't buying it, and he tells his men to do whatever it takes to make Jimmy talk. Obviously, his men were also on that phone call. So, group phone call, conference call, whatever. Peter says that the FBI techs had found an email chain that led them to this particular conversation, but unfortunately for Jimmy, the emails were a setup. He thought he was going to meet a whistleblower, but it was Van Horn's men, and now he's somewhere inside the Barrett Dunn facility, surrounded by lots of men with lots of guns. The only way they're going to be able to get in and extract Jimmy is if they can take Barrett Dunn and Van Horn by surprise and do that quickly enough that Barrett Dunn's soldiers don't have time to react and prevent them from getting their mission accomplished. Otherwise, it could turn into a hostage situation, or Van Horn could kill Jimmy and claim it was self-defense. And since everything involving Barrett Dunn and Van Horn can be buried under the cloak of national security, nothing would be done about it. Nothing could be done about it. Neil suggests that they try to figure out where Jimmy is being held before the FBI descends on Barrett Dunn in an effort to increase their odds of success. Since Diana is a diplomat's daughter, and still has some friends in the State Department, Peter asks her to use those contacts to convince Van Horn to take a meeting the first thing next morning with a high-ranking naval commander who's looking to do business with Barrett Dunn. This will give Neil an opportunity to poke around. And when Peter asks Neil if he thinks he can pull off pretending to be a naval commander, Neil says, sure, he's done it before. He was an admiral in the Royal Navy. Peter quickly tells everyone there, you didn't hear that. Nobody heard that. Next, we see Neil getting outfitted with electronics that will give him communications with the team and the ability to clone Van Horn's security access card, which will then, in turn, give Neil access to the entire facility. All he has to do is maneuver to get the wrist pad that he's wearing close enough to Van Horn's card to clone it. Jones asks Peter for permission to lead the team into Barrett Dunn once they get the info from Neil, but Peter turns him down. Jones pleads with him, says he knows he screwed up. He let the situation with Isabel and Van Horn get personal and under his skin, but he promises it won't happen again. And we don't get the answer at this point. We're inside Barrett Dunn next. Neil is dressed as a naval commander in dress whites, finishing a tour with Van Horn. As they prepare to go their separate ways, Neil gives Van Horn a two-handed shake of sorts, one hand to hand, one hand, the other one with the wrist pad, to Van Horn's forearm next to the security badge on his jacket. Mission accomplished. The two men go their separate ways, with Neil seemingly headed to the front door. But after a moment, when he sees that Van Horn has left the area, he doubles back. He approaches a secure elevator, uses the cloned card to gain access, and informs Peter that there's a staircase off the 8th floor elevator that Van Horn noticeably avoided. So that's where he's headed. In his office, we see Van Horn preparing to depart. He gets a call from one of his people informing him that the helicopter is inbound. Van Horn responds that he wants Jimmy ready to transport and to call Teterboro and tell them one passenger for Johannesburg. No, Jimmy won't be making the trip, as he's going to be exiting the helicopter somewhere over the Hudson River, doubtless without the benefit of parachute. Meanwhile, Neil is up on the 9th floor. He reports that the floor is completely deserted except for an armed guard outside one room, and the team concludes that that is where Jimmy is being held. Peter orders his teams to move in, with one group surrounding the building and the other entering. As the FBI enters the building and begins moving through, one of Van Horn's henchmen enters his office and informs him of the situation. Van Horn checks the security monitor displays, orders all electronic communications in the area jammed, the elevators disabled, and for his men to delay the FBI long enough for him to grab Jimmy and get the two of them to the helicopter. But there's one other thing that Van Horn has seen on the monitors. Neil. He tells the henchmen to order the guard on the ninth floor off his post. He's not needed there anymore. Van Horn steps over to a weapons display on the wall, sets down the pistol he's carrying, pulls down a high-tech compound bow. He says the FBI might hear gunshots, but they won't hear this. With communications jammed, Peter and Neil can't contact each other, and with the elevator shut down, the team has no choice but to go to the ninth floor the old-fashioned way, climb the stairs. In the meantime, Neil sees the guard be called away from the door, and he begins to move toward it, peeks through a window, sees Jimmy, and begins picking the lock. But his efforts are halted when an arrow whizzes by, barely missing him. Neil turns and sees Van Horn holding the bow. Van Horn loads another arrow, aims at Neil, and we see the spot from the laser pointer up on Neil's chest. Okay, now I gotta point out a problem, I think. He's got a laser pointer on the bow. And not only did Van Horn miss with the shot, the first shot, a shot which should have been a slam dunk given the pointer and the short range and Neil's stationary position. In fact, we didn't even see the pointer on the first shot. So he didn't use the pointer. Why not? And why did he miss? As much as I try, I can't come up with a rational sort of explanation for this. Were the circumstances different, I might say that Van Horn was toying with Neil, the thrill of the hunt, because he does reference that later. But given that he's trying to get out of the building as fast as he can before the FBI gets to him, I don't think that really works. I think the thrill of the hunt is just something that comes to him in the moment. Anyway, Neil sees the pointer on his chest and rolls away, hops to his feet, and begins running. Van Horn takes another shot, misses, and then leisurely begins following Neil. Neil seems to be getting away, running down halls and then down a set of stairs, but he's blocked by locked doors. Van Horn stands at the top of the stairs while Neil is hiding behind the wall at the bottom. Van Horn taunts Neil by declaring that nothing beats the thrill of shooting at a live target. Neil runs, Van Horn fires another arrow, Neil dives, and the arrow misses. Van Horn comes to the bottom of the stairs with another arrow loaded and begins closing on Neil. And just as he prepares to fire at extremely short range, making it almost impossible for him to miss, although he did once already, Jones comes up behind, pistol drawn, and orders Van Horn to drop the bow as Peter, Diana, and other agents arrive on the scene. After Van Horn is secured and Diana picks up Neil from the floor, Jones goes to bring Jimmy out of the holding room. Jimmy greets Jones by commenting that Jones must have gotten his postcard. Jones says, yes, and you owe me a flat-screen TV. Later, Jones is walking with Isabel. She is telling him about the charges that Jimmy is facing, and Jones says that, well, despite all the things that Jimmy did and is charged with, he got out before the murder, and he helped the FBI take down Van Horn. So that should at least give him some leverage to negotiate a reduced sentence. After a bit more discussion about Jimmy's recent choices, Jones asks Isabel if she and Jimmy are going to make it. Isabel really doesn't have an answer other than to say that he's going to do time. She'll help him get through it, and then after that, who knows? Jones tells her that Jimmy's a lucky guy. Isabel says that Jones is also a lucky guy, and then she leaves. Back at the FBI, Peter and Diana and Neil are discussing the case and a possible stakeout when Jones arrives. When Neil states that pounding his thumb with a hammer would be preferable to another stakeout in the van, Jones says, yeah, he'll do it. He's kind of missing doing them right now. And we learn that Peter is skipping out on his regular Friday night poker game, choosing instead to join Jones in the van. Neil steps away from the group, calls Mozzie, and lets him know that Peter is skipping poker, but is firmly out of the way for the evening. Mozzie responds that he's on his way to the Suit family estate, and that, no, they don't have to like what they're going to do, but it has to be done. At the Burke home, we see Mozzie waiting for Elizabeth as she's preparing to go out with him for the evening. dinner and an art exhibit. She teasingly accuses him of having pulled a fast one because it typically takes months to get into the Laurent. Mozzie downplays the accomplishment, saying, "Oh, it's nothing. I know a guy who blackmailed a guy. Something about spandex. I don't ask questions." They leave out the front door, with Elizabeth arming the security system, and simultaneously, Neil slips in the back door. In the few seconds it takes before the security system changes from armed to active, which is designed to give people a chance to get out of the house before they trip the alarm by mistake, Neil moves across from the back of the house to the front and then turns off the alarm. We see him searching the house for the safe, and after a bit, he finds it. He works his way through the combination lock portion, then, having succeeded at that, uses the key to finally open the safe. As he opens the door of the safe, Satchmo, who's been observing, gives a tilt of the head and a questioning whine. Neil guiltily tells the dog not to look at him like that. Neil reaches in, picks at a few things, and then finds the target of the mission, the sub-manifest. He looks at it for a few moments, then his eyes fall on a photo nearby. It's a photo of the FBI white-collar team, Peter, Diana, Clinton, and others, and Neil. Everyone in the photo is smiling. Neil is sitting next to Peter, and Peter has his arm draped over Neil's shoulder. After a couple of moments, he tears his attention away from the photo, pulls out his phone, and photographs the manifest. And just then, the phone starts vibrating from an incoming call.
"Hey, Peter, how's the stakeout?"
"Jones is on a coffee run. Listen, that call you made before you left the office tonight."
"Yeah."
"Was it Sarah?"
"She hasn't been taking my calls."
"Oh, man. Well, that's gotta be weighing on you."
"You have no idea."
"Listen, you and I have been through some stuff. And we've had to keep things from each other, but if you want to talk, and really talk, I'm here for you. I think you deserve some happiness. And whatever I can do to help you with that, let me know."
"Thanks, Peter. That means a lot."
Ouch. As if seeing the photo of Peter and Neil and the rest of the FBI team wasn't enough, now he has this. The sense of guilt at his betrayal of Peter and Elizabeth, Peter in particular, that he's already feeling, and which was ratcheted up by seeing the photo, is now even stronger. Of course, when Peter asks about the phone call that Neil made from the office to Mozzie, he's thinking it was actually to Sarah. And of course, Neil doesn't really lie to Peter about it, because he doesn't say it was Sarah, but he does give a truthful, if misleading, answer. He says, "Sarah's not taking his calls." When Peter says, "That's got to be weighing on you," Neil's response of, "You have no idea," is in the context of the conversation about Sarah not taking his calls and the failure of that relationship weighing on his mind. And I think that is partly true. I think that is part of what is weighing on him. But I think also it's about the betrayal, his betrayal of Peter, that he's in the middle of committing. We've already seen throughout the episode signs that he was reluctant to break into Peter's house. And we've seen in the past few episodes signs of his internal conflict between the choices that he's faced with, choosing to keep the treasure and the life that would give him, but having to sacrifice his desire for that different life, a life with Sarah, a life of doing something that's meaningful, being surrounded by people he cares about and respects, and how keeping the treasure would require betrayal of those people and the betrayal of that other life that he could choose. And if he chose that other life, a life with Sarah, the life of doing something meaningful, surrounded by people he cares about and respects, it would mean the sacrifice of the treasure. His sacrifice of never having to worry about money, something which seems deeply emotionally important to him, and important beyond the mere fact of having it because he enjoys having it. It seems to be a very deep-seated need for him to have that. Almost, I don't want to say obsession, but a compulsion to have that. And of course, then there's the betrayal, or the seeming betrayal of Mozzie, that choosing that other life would seem to result in. And he's seen that other life as a possibility for himself. So he's got all these internal conflicts going. And of course, his choices keep interfering with both possibilities. They keep creating problems for both possibilities. So he's really divided in not only his emotions, but also in his actions. Anyway, Peter acknowledges that they've both been through some stuff together and that there have been times that they've had to keep secrets from each other. And if Neil wants to talk, Peter will be there to listen. All of that is sort of him saying that, I think it's him saying that whatever it is that you've done that's made me mad, that's caused me to accuse you of trying to scam me, that's caused problems between us. I may not understand why you did all those things, and I probably wouldn't agree with why you did those things. And maybe you don't fully understand why you did those things or, you know, whatever it is. But whatever it is, I want to help. I'll try not to be judgmental or get angry or criticized. I just want to help you achieve that different life that I know deep down you're wanting to find for yourself. I am your friend, and I am here for you. Of course, that doesn't mean that Peter's going to turn a blind eye in the future, but I do think that it means, for the most part, that everything that Neil has done in the past, that Peter's aware of, is just that. It's in the past. Yeah, maybe I'm reading too much into that, but I think Peter is really telling Neil that no matter what, I'm your friend. Anyway, after Peter and Neil hang up, Mozzie calls, and he's wanting to know if Neil found the safe. Yes, he found the safe. Did he get in? Yes, he got in. Did he find the manifest? Neil hesitates, looking down at the manifest. Then he tells Mozzie, no, manifest wasn't in there. But we both knew it was a long shot. Mozzie haltingly agrees that, yes, they knew it was a long shot. But, and I think he has some, let's say, doubts about what Neil's telling him. He can't put his finger on it, but there's something in what Neil's saying or how he's saying it that just, it's off. Anyway, Neil begs off the phone call, saying that he's got to get out and they can talk tomorrow. They both hang up, but Neil doesn't leave. He sits there contemplating, looking at a nearby photo of Peter and Elizabeth, and he sighs. Just a reminder that you can find the official website at www.whitecollaredpc.com, and I will have links to the resources I've mentioned, and I will also have some show notes there for you. And there will also be ways that you can donate to help support the podcast by helping cover some of the monthly costs that we have. Anyway, I want to thank you for listening and ask you to join me for the next episode as I share my thoughts on Season 3, Episode 9, entitled On the Fence. Until then, take care and God bless.